Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is Sir John Armitt, CBE. Sir John holds several important positions, including Chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission, Chairman of National Express Group, and Chairman of the City and Guilds Group. Sir John, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you.
I want to start off because you're a civil engineer by training and by background. That's right, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
And you always strike me as a man of, you know, a man of doing and a man of action. And, you know, you want to see things get done, even though you're, you know, that you're the chair of commissions and you've done reviews and you've written lots of things. You always strike me as a man that likes to see things happen. So, I mean, how does your background influence, you know, the way you think about cities and infrastructure?
Well, I suppose, you know, you go all the way back to saying, well, why be a civil engineer in the first place? And, I mean, being frank, I was not the world's sort of top of the class when it came to maths and physics. But the description of civil engineering was harnessing the resources of nature for the benefit of mankind. Now, of course, today that's been expanded to to say harnessing the resources of nature in a sustainable way for the benefit of mankind. And it was, you know, very much about traveling. It was about an outdoor life. It was, you know, and I went into contracting. And, you know, the beauty of contracting is that, coming back to your point about, you know, doing things every day when you go home, something's a foot higher or a foot longer, you know, so, and you can see it. So it's sort of physically manifest, and you get that satisfaction of actually sort of building something which, you know, is going to be useful at the end of the day, whether you're building a drainage system or you're building a motorway or you're building, you know, something in the city, buildings as opposed to physical, commonly called physical infrastructure. So yes, I mean, and I think at the end of the day, I argue, broadly speaking, as an engineer of any discipline, you know, fundamentally, if you just stop and think, there is absolutely nothing that we do which is not influenced by engineering. Engineers sort of either they manufacture things, they, you know, they create things, they create all the physical artifacts which enable us to live our lives, or to press the switch and have electricity or whatever else it might be. So in that sense, and civil engineering, of course, if you focus on that as being about transport, about supply of water, treatment of water, the provision of a sewage system, increasingly, of course, enabling the provision of telecommunication systems. You know, everything again comes back to that core infrastructure, without which we cannot live a civilized life. So it's absolutely fundamental to cities.
And what do you think? I mean, you know, you're now involved in sort of policy related conversations. You know, I tend to spend most of my time talking about policy, how policy should be crafted and how it should be, and thought about. I mean, what's your sense as to, you know, those two worlds, the world of doing and the world of policy? Maybe that's unfair to think of it like that, but how do you think about that? What does each get wrong about or get right about each other?
Well, it's a very good question. And of course, the doing bit comes at the end of the process. And so you start with somebody with a policy, as you say, and ideally with a vision as to what it is that they're going to be what needs to be created. And then that has to go through a whole political process of, do we need this? Don't we need this? Can we approve this? Can we afford it? Or indeed, if it's going to be provided by the private sector, what policies do we have to put in place to enable the private sector or encourage the private sector to invest in these things? Then you get into planning, then you get into design and so on. Finally, you get down to where I started in life, which was, well, here you are, Mr. Contractor, will you go and build this for us?
Build this for me, yeah.
But, you know, and sort of, as I've got older, so I suppose I've moved back up the chain to the point where now I'm much more involved in policy. And the key thing about policy is that, and one of the challenges of infrastructure, of course, is that very often you're building things or you're in systems which are going to be there for 50 years. So you can see that the policy maker is almost terrified of getting it wrong, because if he gets it wrong, oh God, we've got, you know, we've got a white elephant here, which isn't going to be of no use, or it's only going to be of use for 10 years. So the challenge is, you know, how do we look forward in the long term and say, well, what is it that we're going to need? Because once we build it, we're stuck with it for anything from 50 to 100 years.
So does that mean does that inevitably mean the policymaker becomes more, you know, risk aware and more cautious and more timid in what they might say? I mean, this is particularly relevant in a national infrastructure context, as you say, yeah, where you're built, you know, you're putting in big things that are going to last for, you know, for an awful long time. But does that mean a policy, you know, by definition, becomes more cautious, more risky, more timid?
Absolutely. And I would argue you can see it manifest at the moment in the great difficulty that the government is having in producing an energy policy. You know, they're being challenged by new technologies. They've got old technologies. You know, do we carry on with the old technologies, by which I mean particularly nuclear, or do we actually say, well, we can have a renewables future? And then people will say, ah, well, you know, you're not too sure about renewables, and you know they're not so consistent, and so you need a backup capacity. And the interesting thing, of course, is that your new wind turbine probably only actually has a life of about 15 years, whereas your nuclear power station is going to be more like 35 years. But yes, I think policy is fundamentally politics, and of course, politicians, therefore, are going to be risk averse. Occasionally, they'll go out on a limb, of course, as what we call sort of vanity projects. And of course, you can get pork barrel politics as well, where things get built in particular places because of particular constituencies, or in America, particular states, wherever it is. I mean, it happens all over the world, where in fact, central government is wanting to reward local government by giving them some infrastructure, almost because we want to give them something to get the votes, regardless of whether what is actually being given is actually the right thing to be given. So I say consistently, there is no infrastructure without politics, because fundamentally you've got to, and it's politicians who have to either make a decision to spend public money, or they have to invoke policies which are going to influence the private sector to build infrastructure. So this political policy debate at the beginning is absolutely critical. And I would equally argue that one of the weaknesses of the past has been that largely it happens without consulting with the public. So the guy is the customer, if you like, and we all say these days, oh, you know, you've got to listen to the customer. The customer is king, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that might be true in John Lewis. I'm not sure it's yet true when it comes to the development of infrastructure policy. And listening to what the public actually believe is going to be of best value to them, what they can afford, because they pay eventually. The public pay for all our infrastructure one way or the other eventually.
Yeah. And that, I think, you know, that issue around the, you know, the politics and the sort of technical and the politics, I suppose. I mean, you, and I know you touched on it in different places, but you looked at that in your 2013 review, and in part, I suppose, that's what the National Infrastructure Commission is trying to do, really, is trying to straddle the politics and the deliverable. What can we do? What should we be doing? Yeah. And where is that fair or is that right?
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, the review came about because of what was seen by, and in fact, it was by the Labour Party, and it was Ed Balls who said to me, John, the Olympics has been a great success. And we can all see that one of the reasons it's been a success was because there was a cross-party political support for this, and everybody thought it was the right thing to do. Why can't we do that more often? Why can't we actually get this agreement on what we should be building, and why can't we build successfully on time, to budget, etc.? And could you go away and think about that and come back and give us a report on what we would need to do to try and move in that direction? So that resulted in the report, which we handed over in 2015, which fundamentally, and of course it went further than we currently are, that report actually recommended that an infrastructure commission should make recommendations to Parliament rather than to the government. And that Parliament should then debate and arrive at a policy as a consequence of the debate. and pass a bill, which then would make it much more difficult to go into reverse and change it, because you've actually created that policy through an Act of Parliament. Not surprisingly, of course, when it comes to the crunch, and it wouldn't have made any difference, I don't think, whether it was Conservative or Labour.
No.
They say, well, not sure about that. We're the government. We want to make the decisions. So let's have the Infrastructure Commission report to the government, and the government will then respond and decide whether or not to take these policies and projects forward. Originally, I think everybody thought it was about projects. Increasingly, I tend to think it's as much about policy as it is about projects. And therefore, a lot of the recommendations that we've made to government over the last 5 years have been much about policy as they have been about individual projects.
And the way that we approach these sorts of questions and issues in the UK, John, I mean, how do you have a sense as how we compare to, you know, other countries that we would compare ourselves to, or that be in our peer group? Are we unique, or are we like them?
Part of the study I did was we went around the world and tried to understand what other people were doing. The only people that we found who have a totally sort of methodical approach to it, and this might not be surprising, was Singapore. And Singapore actually have a 50-year vision and plan, and then they break that back into 10-year programs. So they've got this 50-year, this is where we want to be, 50 years. They use an international commission to advise them on that. And then it's given to the individual government departments, and they're told, right, now that's where we're trying to get to. Now produce a 10-year plan, Mr. Highways Department or Mr. Drainage Department, whoever it might be, to help us meet that 50-year vision. And they produce these 10 years. Every 10 years, they have another 10-year rolling program of activity. And they move the civil servants around so that they all have a part to play at some point in being at the center of the 50-year work, as well as being on the 10-year work, so that they don't sort of get locked into that sort of very long-term or that shorter-term view. In Ontario, in the Canada, they've tried to have a go at that sort of an infrastructure commission long-term approach. Australia has an infrastructure commission, interestingly chaired by Rod Eddington, who of course used to be here.
Indeed.
It's slightly different. Rod has money. And the way it works with Rod is that they have a sort of view at the center as to what broadly they're trying to achieve. But because it's a federal government, it's the states who make the individual sort of decisions about what they're going to build in a particular state. But if they want government support, so they come to the commission and say, look, we're going to build this new airport or this new port. We think this is how it fits into your overall picture.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Eddington, please now can we have a few hundred million to to go and deliver it? And they will release money according to whether they think these projects actually fit the big picture. Surprisingly, the French and the Germans, not so much. I mean, the French did do it, obviously, way back with the nuclear power program and then with the high-speed rail program. But they haven't had, apparently, a long-term plan since the mid-90s. So they've almost gone backwards from being very long-term in their thinking to being shorter-term.
And do you think the ability of governments to be long-term in that nature has become more difficult over time?
Yes.
You know, and do you think they, you know, because of the conditions that are out there, because of the volatility, because of the change, in a sense, you know, doing that is all the more difficult?
No, I think it is. No, you know, I don't envy politicians because you know, the commission is a voice. There will be 20 other voices all seeking to be heard and making their arguments as to why, you know, the commission's view is not right and their view is a better view. And, you know, the politician, generally speaking, is going to be a layman, you know, without probably any engineering background at all. And therefore, it's difficult for him. So he then becomes reliant on the civil servants. The danger with being reliant on the civil servants, of course, so you get, well, on the one hand, minister, and on the other hand, minister. And, you know, you can see how, if you're not careful, you almost get to a lowest common denominator conclusion. or no conclusion. Yes. And of course, the risk, which has been pointed out to us on many times, that, well, you know, people say to me, well, John, technology is changing so quickly. How can you have this certainty? You know, and surely you've got to wait. I say, yeah, but I can't wait forever. I've got to make a decision. Right or wrong, you occasionally have to make a decision, and take a chance that, in a sense, you've got your judgment right about how future technology is going to develop.
Yeah, yeah. And one final question on the sort of positioning. I mean, it'd be interesting. I've heard a lot, you probably hear as well, you know, the UK is particularly bad at delivering projects on time and within budget. You know, we do these things far worse than anywhere else. I mean, what is there any validity to that kind of, you know, criticism or not? Or is that just a, you know, a kind of classic, just depending on people's agendas?
I think it's, I think if you're comparing us with Western democracies, then we're no worse than anybody else. I mean, America has had its, you know, the Big Dig, as it was called in Boston, was a classic, you know, years and years late, sort of treble the cost that was originally envisaged. Even Germany and France have their, I mean, look at Germany at the moment with an airport, which was, should have been open 3 years ago, still not open. No, everyone has their problems. There usually are very big projects, which therefore catch the public eye. Yeah. And the danger is, of course, that then becomes, oh, well, everything's wrong. Whereas if you take the largest highway project in Europe in recent years has been actually the work which has been going on the A14. Now, the A14 was quietly opened recently, 6 months early. But nobody talks about that.
Nobody talks about that. No. But things are going to plan and go, you know, under budget, of course, you know, that's not news, is it?
That's not news. No.
Not news at all.
But of course, by and large, what I would say is that where one of the weaknesses lies in this, and I describe this as why, what, and how. We love to talk about the how, because we all understand how we're going to do something. Why we're doing it in the first place, well, you know, we skate through that bit. We don't want to spend too much money on that because that means paying consultants, and consultants are horrible people and they charge too much money. But actually, spending a bit more time thinking through, why are we doing this? What are the options? What are the choices? Do we need to build at all? Or actually, can we use existing resources, or can we do things with what we have? Doesn't get debated sufficiently, and part of the why, of course, is that public engagement as well. Because if you can get the public on board during the why, then when it actually comes to the, well, now this is what we've actually got to build, this is the precise alignment, and this is how we're going to do it, at least you've got the public on board that this is a sensible thing to be doing.
But
if you rush into it, you're almost certainly going to then have to change the design. And as soon as you start changing things, that's when delays occur and that's when costs go up.
Yeah, no, and that's a perfect segue, because I wanted just to get your thoughts on, you know, the relationship between, you know, with infrastructure and infrastructure investment and provision and economic growth. And particularly, you know, there's a big strand of your work, both within the NIC, but actually across your career around, you know, cities and, you know, the important role of urban in all of those sorts of things. But just your thoughts on, you know, how we ought to think about, you know, the provision of infrastructure and its relation to urban economic growth. Because, I mean, very crudely, again, get your thoughts on it. It seems to me that on the one hand, we can say, you know, infrastructure is essentially removing, you know, it's reducing congestion, it's reducing blockages in stuff that we can see. We know that there's congestion, and therefore, if we add extra infrastructure of the right type, it reduces congestion. That's one version. The other version, in the sense, is that we want places to be more successful. You know, they're currently underperforming, and infrastructure is a way to kind of release that or get into that sort of potential, that transformational sort of effects that we often hear about. But, you know, just your thoughts on that sort of debate, and what are we missing if we...
Well, the more developed a country is, then probably the less benefit will flow solely from an infrastructure investment. But if you're starting in a green field with nothing, then you can't do anything without infrastructure. But once you've got an established, let's say, infrastructure, which is working reasonably well, but actually not as well as it could, then improving that infrastructure will help to increase the economy for the sort of reasons you say. It's easier to move around, there's less congestion. Just getting into a city or to a city becomes easier. So if it's easier, then people are more likely to make it. And so it encourages agglomeration. But it's only part of the story. The other two parts of the story, if you're an investor and if you're somebody saying, well, am I going to start my business here? Am I going to invest in my business? It's, well, what do I want in order to be able to invest? One of the next first questions is there a skilled labor force? Are there people there with the relevant skills that I can recruit? Interestingly, Siemens wind blade factory in the UK on the East Coast was situated in an area where they used to build caravans. Caravans are fiberglass, molded, et cetera, et cetera. What is a wind turbine blade? Molded fiberglass. So what seems almost odd, caravans and wind turbines, there is actually a connection which caused them to say, well, that won't be a bad place because these are fundamentally made by hand. They're not made by robots.
Right.
And they're laid up in the same way as you would lay up a ship's hull of plastic. And so for them, that was part of the decision to invest in that factory in that area, which now employs 1,000 people. So skills are absolutely critical and fundamental, and one of the biggest challenges, quite frankly, that we face in the next 10, 15 years. And then, of course, there are these other issues about, is this the right place for me to invest because have I got the connectivity? Is there an agglomeration between my business and other businesses, which of course then leads you rather dangerously down the path of spatial planning, which is not the most popular subject to put in front of politicians, but I would argue is a very valid consideration which needs to be taken into place, because not every city in the country can be the one which has a digital future. Not every city in the country can come at the centre of advanced manufacturing. Not every city in the country can become the future of manufacturing medical products or medicines. You've got to actually have some idea. And this is why I think that to a certain extent, you almost need to have a spatial strategy alongside an industrial strategy, which then actually leads next to your infrastructure strategy, which is going to support those two even larger scale policy thinking, which is necessary.
Yeah. And how does... Now, how does sort of, the conurbations, we start with the big places, but, you referenced other things, but, you've done a lot of work and focus on sort of Greater Manchester and Greater Liverpool and Greater Leeds and Greater Birmingham, et cetera. The big sort of chunky bits of the country where lots of people live, lots of firms are located. How does that fit into that, to that perspective and your the way you're trying to understand how the country functions, how the economy functions, and then what's the role of infrastructure in that?
Well, if you take the study that we're doing at the moment on rail connectivity across the Midlands and across the Northwest, Northeast, and how that all relates to High Speed 2, which is a study we'll be giving the government in November. What you're seeking to do is to enable these different cities to be able to, and they're quite close together relatively, but to be able to, for people to be able to move between them easily so that they're encouraged to move. They can decide to live in Manchester and work in Leeds because it's going to take them half an hour, not an hour, to make the journey. It's rather like people who live outside London will go on the train into London because they can do it. I used to live in Berkhamsted. You can get in 23 minutes. But if you try to drive from Berkhamsted into the centre of London, it'd take you an hour at least.
Yes.
But therefore, it becomes somewhere which becomes, in fact, quite a successful small town because it's got that ease of communication from there into where the majority of the jobs are, which is into London. And so when you're looking at those cities that we're talking about, the interconnectivity between those cities is absolutely crucial. Arguably, when you look at the journey times that people have in the north, when you look at the quality of the rolling stock which they have in the north and compare it with the south and the southeast, it's frankly not as good. And the journey times are considerably longer. The average speeds are considerably longer. So, but if you can improve that and reduce those journey times, and you start to make some impact on enabling that agglomeration of people in businesses to move easily and flexibly between one another.
And in fact, the work that we did an event on together not so long ago, where you were publishing the latest, you know, findings from the Next Step for Cities kind of program, or the Cities program that you've been running over the last year, I suppose, in total. You know, very much central to that was looking at a bunch of places to see what was going on within them, really, and how you could address them. So I'd definitely say something more about that. And then I just get your thoughts on, back to almost where we picked up earlier on, very clearly issues about leadership and about organizing, you know, how institutions are organized in order to make the decisions or develop the plans. So just say a little bit more about the program itself, and then we can get on to question on issues about leadership and your thoughts on that.
Well, I think in terms of the program, of course, we worked with the cities in looking at how they might develop their plans and their ideas. And we came up with eight principles, in fact, which they thought consistently, if applied, would enable them to make a better fist of developing the strategies that they need. And basically, that, like all things, you need to start with a vision. Where are you trying to get to? What's your ambition? But then you've got to start scoping that out. And of course, in scoping it out, you then start to say, well, this isn't just about infrastructure. It's not just about our city. What about the neighboring areas around? Because it's going to impact them. So we need to work together. We need to think about the other aspects which support life, whether it's health, education, and so on, because they'll all be interfaced with simply the infrastructure that we think we might need. Come back again, you've then got to start talking to people, and it's not just talking to yourselves within that city and within that city hall. You need to talk to other departments. You need to talk to other people who bound you and are going to be influenced by what you do. You need to talk to your public, of course. And if you're going to persuade people, then it's got to be based on an evidence base. And you've got to actually have some reasonable evidence that you can show that you're using to predict what might happen, understand what's happened in the past, analyze the data you have from the past, as well as trying to generate data to predict what might happen in the future. If you don't actually take a careful evidence-based approach to evidence, then you're probably going to get undermined pretty quickly, or you won't be able to stand up to cross-examination. And then you're going to have options, because you can't, necessarily, it comes back to the why. You know, it's not necessarily always about big and shiny new. It could be actually about spending money on improving what you have and maintaining it more regularly, looking after it more, making it more reliable, for example, in the meantime. You've got to have priorities, because you can't, if you're not careful, you'll finish up with a wish list, which is too expensive, too long. And so you've got to be prepared to make those difficult decisions about, well, what comes first, and to try and work out a sensible flow of improvements to your city, which actually at the end of the day are going to knit together. But where do I get my, this of course is always of interest to politicians, where do I get my quickest bang for my buck? Yeah. What do I do first to show that I'm actually making some progress and doing things? And you're going to have to stress test your ideas against the uncertainties of the future. So there are a whole series of critical things which you need to do. But I think one of the biggest challenges which we find ourselves making to government is who should be making some of these decisions.
Yes.
And of course, there's been a tendency in the last 50 years or more in the UK for everything to be sucked to the centre. If you go back to the 1960s, 50% of the local authorities' expenditure, they were raising themselves. Today, it's about 10% or less. So they're so dependent on getting money out of central government. Central government then wants to, or very often, have a competition to decide who it's going to give money to. But who should know best what is needed? Well, clearly, people who live locally. And so we've made a strong recommendation to government that it should actually devolve more of this. Not only that, it's one thing to devolve decision-making, but who wants to make a decision if they can't actually decide whether they've got any money or what money they have?
Yeah.
So we would argue that they need to devolve long-term financial programs to these city mayors as well, so that the mayor, together with all his colleagues in the city, can decide, well, what do we really need? How much money are we going to have for the next 10 years, not the next 2 years? And can we plan out our future? And then be responsible and accountable to the people who've put them there for the decisions they make and for selling that vision, for developing that list of priorities with their local electorate, not having to spend all their time down here in London persuading a bunch of civil servants that their idea is worthwhile, and then the civil servants taking it to the minister, and you know, round and round you go.
Yeah.
So it's that devolution of power and decision making, I think, is absolutely fundamental to cities. And of course, you see it in France. I mean, you know, that even in a small town in France, the mayor is all powerful. And some people would say too powerful, but I mean, there's no doubt about it that mayors in cities in France get things done, and they have the ability and the finance to get things done.
Absolutely, and you've made a point in lots of different places about the relationship between, as you say, the funding and the power, and then essentially what that does for capacity at the local level to actually engage seriously in the kind of things that you're talking about, engaging seriously in what it is that we want our place to be. What are the tough decisions we're going to need to make? Because we probably can't do everything, because no place can. You know, that capacity to get stuff done in a broader sense is related to and can only be enhanced because of the powers and funding that's there. Otherwise, why would you build capacity in the absence of, funding and powers, right?
I've said to local mayors, I don't understand why you stand for election. I wouldn't do it. Why would you go out and give the public a whole host of promises that you know you haven't got the ability to keep? I mean, it just doesn't make sense,
No, I've always wondered why people do that. In a sense, why would you give yourself the hassle of doing all those sorts of things when you just get slapped then for not doing what you said when you never had a chance to do it?
But you don't have the power to do it.
No.
The other thing about this, of course, is that the more those sort of really important, valuable decisions and the skills and the ability to make those decisions, if they're being made locally, then those companies who have the ability to provide that service and all those skills, they're going to open offices in those places.
Yeah.
But if they think all the decisions are going to be made in London, well, then what's the point of having an office in Leeds? I might as well stay in London.
Yeah.
But if you know that Leeds has got the ability to actually work all this out for itself, needs all that support to be able to do it, then you say, well, okay, let's move some of our good people up to Leeds. Let's have an office in Leeds, and let's be able to engage with politicians in Leeds and produce a better Leeds.
Yeah.
So it helps to that previous point about how do you actually raise the scale of the quality of an economy. Well, the more you can actually make decisions for yourself, then the more you need good people. And so you gradually start to increase the skill level within your city. And so you start to raise the GVA.
And that helps to address, as you, again, I've heard you speak before about, on the one hand, the sort of announcement on, on a policy or on a kind of funding pot, but actually making sure that we've got a credible and robust pipeline of things that can be funded and actually delivered is critical. And actually, again, the straddling your doing and policy sort of worlds, making sure that we're not just only focused on the announcement or actually the announcement and the availability of cash, but making sure that we can build a pipeline across the country that we can actually get things done.
And of course, if you can start to build that pipeline, then you can start to, if you're what we call an intelligent client, you can start to think about, well, how am I now going to employ my supply chain? And perhaps you can employ your supply chain on a longer term basis. I mean, Anglian Water recently placed a contract for 15 years. They don't know what they're going to want that contractor to do in 10 years or 15 years time, but they would like to have that continuity of engagement, somebody working with them to look at how do we produce more and more efficiently through that period, how do we deliver more and more effectively. From the contractors and the consultants' point of view, they can say, well, if we're going to be locked into this client for the next 15 years, then we've got a real incentive to make sure we've got the trained people, we've got the right people, You know, we're looking at our efficiency, we're looking at how do we actually steadily improve our performance, because you've got that long-term forecast in your business. So everybody potentially can gain from this at the end of the day.
Yeah. And we have to talk about it in a sense, because you know, otherwise it's like, why isn't we this? But your reflections on, you know, on the pandemic, and, you know, obviously there are short run effects that we can see already, you know, effects being felt across the country. You know, we've seen changes in the way that people work and the way that firms operate, which for the minute remain short term, but they may become longer term in nature, particularly if the pandemic stretches on or we get several waves of it, which, you know, is a possibility. We don't know how possible. But I mean, from a National Infrastructure Commission from a national infrastructure perspective, you know, in some respect, we think in 50, 60, 70 years out. So, you know, you assume that the crisis is not with us in 60 or 70 years. It'll be something different rather than the one now. But I mean, how does that factor into, or how has that influenced the way that you think about these sorts of questions and issues, John? How do you, I suppose, you know, distinguish between the short run and the medium or longer run?
Well, we're about to start a piece of work which we'll probably spend a year working on, which is trying to understand behavioural change and look at, and even at the end of a year, of course, there'll be the question, well, OK, but that's the evidence of the last year. How do you know that's going to be valid in 5 years or 10 years? To which the answer is, well, I don't, but at least I've taken what evidence I have got and tried to make some sense of it to draw some conclusions. And all of that will be working into our next 25, 30 year view of life, which we will publish in 2023. So in 2023, we will be publishing a forward look again. And certainly we've got roughly 3 years in which to constantly refine that view by trying to understand the changes which are occurring, the degree to which they're permanent, the degree to which they're temporary. And of course, at the moment, it's very difficult to read. Wearing my National Express hat, I mean, we've clearly seen a more significant fall off in passengers on coaches going long distance. We've seen a more rapid return to normal on the big red bus within cities. So that local use of public transport has come back more quickly than the long distance public transport. And I know that you would see the same on the railways, so they've seen the same. Where, of course, the difficulty is then drawing a line between, well, how much of that is due, and if you take London Underground, how much of that is due to the government actually scaring everybody to the point where, you know, don't use public transport? Well, if the government is constantly saying don't use public transport, then many people will, given that we have an alternative, which we're engaged in at the moment by communicating and working in a different way, then it is possible to work at home. I haven't met anybody who believes that it is, overall, it's more satisfactory than being sat across the table and working face to face. You know, human beings do need human contact, both just being able to shake a hand, put your arms around somebody, as well as pick up all those little nuances around the table, which you can't pick up on a Zoom with 10 different sort of photographs on a Zoom screen. Yes. You're not going to pick up those same body language. And just, as somebody said to me the other day, you know, the start of a meeting is never quite as casual on Zoom as it is when you're just milling around, getting up a cup of coffee and all these other things that we do in normal life.
No,
so I think the question is going to be, to what extent do we, does the need for that pull us back to actually, broadly speaking, a normal life in cities? I mean, cities have recovered for the last 1,000 years. You know, they've recovered from the plague, you know, they've recovered from fire, they've recovered from being destroyed in wars, but they bounce back. And the benefit that comes from an agglomeration of people in a city, I think, is proven beyond doubt. And I don't think, if you, all the forecasts up until COVID around the world were that by 2050, 2035, 2050, 70% of the world was going to be living in cities. Now, if that 70% becomes 60% because of COVID, okay, but it doesn't actually reduce that much the impacts and the need for cities in order to drive successful interpersonal communication, interpersonal relationships, and actually more, I suppose, just more sparks flying and more imagination and more creativity flowing from that, which is what makes for people to be happy in their jobs. I mean, it's interesting at the moment. This is a generalization, obviously, but clearly for many young people, this is awful. You know, if you're sharing a flat with two or three other professional colleagues and you're all having to sort of share the kitchen or share the dining room, or you're working with your laptop on the end of your bed, I mean, yes, that's okay for a couple of months, but it's not okay for the rest of your life. That isn't going to be the rest of your life. We're not going to be able to suddenly change all our housing stock to give everybody more space. I mean, it will create, I think, arguments about have we been making our housing stock individual properties too small? And that's a good thing if we see some pressure to go back to, say, people like Parker Morris that we used to design to in the 60s and 50s and 60s, yeah, which I think were actually higher quality in some ways than what we do today. Mm. No, I think for young people, it's been particularly bad. It's been easiest, frankly, for people like myself, who, you know, if you've got space and you've got space in your home to work, and there's, you know, in our case, now only two of us, you know, we haven't even got to take children to school and things like that. So yeah, it becomes a lot easier. Yeah. But for other people, I think there will be a lot of pressure. The surveys are showing that, by and large at the moment, that a lot of people are saying, well, I'd like that flexibility in the future. And maybe one day a week I'll work from home, or even 2 days a week I'll work from home. But very few people are saying, I just want to work from home in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And does that, I mean, just that issue, John, in a sense, you know, if you think about, you know, think about train systems or tram systems, you know, often they have to be built to almost to the, you know, to be the peak, to respond to the peak, even though we know that the peak is only, you know, 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the evening. But in a sense, all the infrastructure has to be able to cope with that. And then in between, you essentially get a fairly suboptimal use of I mean, how do you think that would play out? Would we just...
I don't know. I mean, because it's those sort of factors are dependent on other factors, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I suspect the school day isn't going to change. So if the school day doesn't change, the school day almost leads to a certain degree to at least, I mean, you know, a lot of modern young families, you know, the husband will drop the children off to school in the morning and start work at 9:30 or 10:00, work through till 5 or 6. His wife has gone in earlier and she finishes at 3:30 and goes and picks the children up. But it's geared around still those other elements of life. Leisure activity is going to come in blocks, I suspect, because if you want a team of people together, they're not all going to be, you know, it is as it is, because, you know, they've all finished work at 5, so they can all be on the pitch at 6:30 or 7. If it's all becomes a lot more flexible, then actually getting the team together is not going to be so necessarily so easy. So I think yes, there may well be a sort of a spreading to a degree of the usage of transport, which would be a good thing, because it would actually take the top off the peak and you wouldn't get so much overcrowding. Of course, what we've seen in the past is that almost as soon as you finish building new infrastructure, it's full within no time at all.
Yes.
I mean, I was on the airport commission looking at, you know, Heathrow, Gatwick and all the rest, and the third runway. By the time that third runway was going to be built, we knew that almost certainly there would have to have been another commission looking at where the next runway in the southeast was going to be.
Yeah.
And I think global travel, I can't see global travel slowing down. I mean, we've seen in COVID the desire that people have to, as quickly as possible, try and get back into their holidays, even if they've been booking them and then having to unbook them because COVID hasn't finished as quickly as they hoped. And with the growth of population and the growth of wealth in developing countries, well, not developing, but countries like China and India,
yes,
that is going to continue to put enormous pressure, I think, on aviation systems and so on. So I think it's, yeah, there will be changes. A lot of them could be changes for the better. I mean, where would we have been if we hadn't have had Wi-Fi and the internet?
Well, quite.
And it's unimaginable. So it's proved the value of that, and it'll of course place more pressure on us getting even better. Place pressure on the rollout of fiber even more quickly to get better quality internet and so on. But I come back to my basic thesis, I think, which is at the moment, I think it would be a very brave person who said that the world we're living in for the last 3 months is the world of the future, because I don't think that's a pleasant place to be for the majority of people.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to kind of overstate this, John, but I mean, in a sense, you know, you're a very experienced and seasoned campaigner. You know, you've been around these issues for, you know, for a good number of times. You've seen them from different points of view. I mean, are you, you know, if you think about, you know, the work that you're currently doing with the commission, are you optimistic and confident that, you know, we can make the decisions that need to be made in a sense that gives us a reasonable chance of future prosperity? Or do you, you know, are you worried that essentially
overall I am confident. And I think one of the things which actually is helping us at the moment is we have got one very strong singular vision at the moment, which is zero carbon and dealing with climate change. And I think that is one sort of very significant factor which sits out there, on which there's very little disagreement at all. And you get cross-party support for that, and people can see that this is something which we have got to adapt the way in which we travel, or the way or how we travel, adapt our energy systems, adapt our use of energy, adapt our use, how we farm, all sorts of things. And I think those are actually leading to a better quality of discussion, a greater sort of a consideration of options, a greater use of evidence. So I think actually I'm quite optimistic, really, because I think if nothing else, climate change is pulling us into a place where we all know that we've got to make better quality decisions. And so, and that combined actually with saying, well, how do we minimize, or how do we, nobody will be able to say there will not be another epidemic. There will be. So what do we learn from this one? Clearly there are just simple things like, well, let's keep in place some of these emergency reserve hospital capacity that we've built, and let's not just sort of throw it away now, let's sort of consider how we maintain it, how we use it, and how we wrap it into our national health system. So I think I think we can come out of this in a much better place, actually. I think it's been an opportunity to reflect, learn, to ask ourselves challenging questions, and I think young people particularly will keep our feet to the fire, which is a great thing. I mean, we've got the young professionals. We had a discussion only yesterday at the NIC with our new young professionals group. And we were actually saying to them, because they were saying, well, we want to feed into the work you are doing and to provide that alternative perspective. And we said, well, the most critical thing is that you don't get too close to us, because we don't want you to become a part of a big group thing within the NIC. Do want you to sort of be coming in from the outside with some really challenging ideas from a younger person's perspective.
Fantastic. Those notes of optimism are a great way to finish. My guest today has been Sir John Armitt.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission. and all rights are reserved.